Okay.
Like, get the.
Okay, all right.
Land use meeting started. June 4th, 3:00. President Bullock will not be attending, neither will Councilman Hollins. In attendance, we have Councilwoman Kilpatrick, Councilman Powers, Councilman Weiner, Councilman Smiley, Councilman Co-Chair Tackett, Councilman Sheldon, YA Chrissy Roberts, myself, and Councilman Street attending. It's a pleasure on the minutes.
Motion approved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, first thing on the agenda, we have, it's a resolution 13. It's plan of French Park. And it's in Councilman Tackett's co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this plan is actually going to get deferred to not absolutely sure he's sponsoring at this point, but it'll be deferred to the council president for sponsorship. This plan lies in my district, although I have spoke with the council attorney, and I feel like I do have a conflict of interest with this plan. I did lay out the issues. The applicant's attorney is here. The plan has been around for a long time. I had dealt with it when it was on the 740 Alliance. Then Councilwoman Vineski had worked with Representative Oberle, Senator DeLuca. I think they were bound in some legislation or lawsuits too, I think, or something. But and I had opposed it when I was president of the 740 Alliance. Shortly coming onto council, the attorney's applicant had chosen to depose me, you know, brought me into the office. He did it as a private citizen, although I was a councilman now, and this is a project that would lie in my district. So it still affected me as a councilman ultimately at one day. So given the history, everything that had happened in the past with it, a plan that I had clearly never supported when I was in the community here now, I chose to go ahead and recuse myself on this plan. The applicant did, and I do thank him for reaching out to me. He's the only one I heard of, and he did get this a little bit late, you know, was notified of it on the plan, but I do appreciate at least him reaching out to me. I did get back a few things to him late today, but they're really general things. The entrance to the site, the community was concerned with the curving of Salem Church Road, Cedar Farms on Raybalt Road. Many years ago had flooded in the back, and the people had to be, you know, evacuated with a boat there. So they were concerned about additional flooding that could occur, you know, and I explained some of that to them. And I don't think they were probably required, but I did ask about, the community had asked about, had any of the studies been done in case there were any federally protected species on the property, since it had been so long and it is very wet in there. But that's all we really had on it. So, I mean, they were really just kind of things you hear. And what type, being an old plan, would there be any type of clubhouse, playgrounds, and what's the public transportation requirements be? Though it is a 2001 plan, I think is what it's called. 2001 plan?
Well, sort of, it's a hybrid.
Hybrid, yeah.
I'll get into that a little
okay.
further.
So, and at this point, with the council president not being here, the council pro tem not being here, we're deferring to my co-chair.
Yes, I'm going to introduce it today, and then we'll see how the council president is on regular introduction for a vote. With that, we have Councilman Bell standing and Councilwoman Diller, and I believe.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to proceed?
Well, I'd just like to say a couple things. I believe that was said in the past, the entrance to Salem Church Road, and I believe Councilman Tackett brought it up, was approaching the traffic, and then there's some major flooding in the areas in the back of Cedar Farms. And then this was sent to you, I believe, Mr. Abbott, and it has been, had been any reports on a sensitive area within this project, as well as the recent study to see if any endangered species. And will the area transit access, and will the site have clubhouses and playground areas? Okay, Mr. Abbott?
Thank you, Councilman Redd, Mr. Chairman. Richard Abbott on behalf of the applicant, Salem Church Associates. We have some color handouts that if you council members, I'll actually pass them out. Council members. Deb Sidaram is here with Parents and Associates. He is the project engineer. And the settlement agreement that was, I believe, referenced by Councilman Hackett was entered into a few years ago to resolve pending litigation. There was a 2001 plan that gave rise to litigation. That's sort of water under the bridge at the moment, as this is a compromise plan that was agreed upon after conferring with the Land Use Department, obtaining input in conformance with the settlement agreement. This project covers actually technically two parcels that total just over 100 acres. They'll obviously be combined into one parcel. And the development includes 511 residential units made up of 372 apartments, which are located at the front of the site. And then the rear of the site that you see on the color plan in front of you will be 139 townhouses. The property is zoned DPUD. It was originally approved, I guess, in the exploratory plan in 1974, but it's been much reduced, including, obviously, there's no commercial at this point. The original DPUD had commercial development included. This is a purely residential project. The project includes 74 acres of open space out of the 101 plus minus acres. The apartments include 759 parking spaces, and you can sort of see these wetland areas that you'll notice are avoided. Those are the federal jurisdictional wetlands. There were a few small pockets of isolated wetlands, which are only protected by the UDC, which we obtained variance for, and there's a mitigation condition that was imposed based on the RIPATIC recommendation and the Board of Adjustment adoption of their recommendation. So that will be part of the development to mitigate those small areas that are affected or in essence will be filled. And at this point, I know there were some questions that Councilman Tackett sent over, most of which, if not all of which, I think are more down our engineer, Dev Sidaram's line, and he can address those. But just by way of background, the litigation involved both the county and the state. DelDOT met with us before we executed the settlement agreement. DelDOT vetted the plans, conferred with our engineers, worked on the appropriate location of the entrance. There's easements that we provided because eventually DelDOT intends to put one of those multimodal paths in along this side, the west side of Salem Church Road. And I guess I neglected to mention it's just a short distance north of Route 40 and just south of Raybould Road. So DelDOT intends to place multimodal paths when? I don't know. DelDOT would have to answer that question, but they have the right of way pursuant to our agreement and the dedication that's shown on the plan. Obviously, there are certain natural areas and so forth. That's the subject of the conservation easement that gets imposed pursuant to the plan. And so, in effect, as you can see, the development's rather isolated on the site, and we've tried to limit and to minimize any impacts. Because, of course, some of this area, or a lot of this area, is actually forested. The one side note I would indicate, you'll see the difference in the color green. There's a strip there at the northern side of the property. That's a Delmarva Power transmission line right-of-way. So the reason that it's different is, in fact, it's denuded in its entirety because they want to keep it clear along the full breadth of that, and it's 250 foot wide DP&L easement. So And then, of course, just to orient you, the northernmost boundary of this site is a stream known as Muddy Run. So obviously this is approximate. When the surveyors survey it, they approximate where the center line of the stream is. The southernmost boundary of the site is owned by the county, which is the Bex Woods Park property. The pond itself is a fair distance south, but technically it directly abuts it. And the property to the west, I'm not sure who the Burton Pyle property is, but per DLDOT requirements, I know this is always sort of a bugaboo, but per DLDOT requirements, there's an interconnection should that neighboring property ever be developed. And so we've got notes on here to comply with the county UDC requirements regarding notification of that and so forth. So with that, I think that gives you the general background. I'll hand it over to Dev Sitaram, who had a few more engineering details he wanted to provide.
Before we get started, we have Councilman Cartier has joined us, and I believe Councilman Weiner wants to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I applaud DLDOT for the multimodal path. I assume that's for both bicycles and pedestrians. Where does that lay out on this parcel?
Mr. Sitaram could explain it, but it's right along the west side of Salem Church Road.
Okay.
I believe we gave him a 10-foot wide.
15.
Sorry. Great, 15, because there's actually, in what's called whole streets federal legislation, a requirement to accommodate both pedestrians and bicyclists, hence the 15 feet. I'm also pleased to hear, and I know not everyone agrees with me on this, but the dedication of the stubbed road for interconnectivity in the future. That was all I had to say.
Happy to do it.
Right. The only way to get to it.
Right. Really, it's landlocked.
Right. Yeah, could you just have the applicant point on the state strategies map as to where this project is for the benefit of the public, please?
Yeah. I wonder who it says there.
Should be in this. Where's Fex Pond? It should be. It's tough to tell because Salem Church Road is not on here, but it's somewhere in this area in the red zone, north of Route 40, obviously west of Route 7, and then east of Sunset Lake Road. Assuming this water body here is Bex Pond, and it's just north of there. Delineated in the red.
So it would be east of
strategy level 1.
So 72, that is 72, Route 40. So it's east of 72 and north of Route 40. So I believe the blue body is Bex Pond, so it would be somewhere.
The Bex Pond
either
area
level
is
1 or level 2. Maybe partially level 2. Partially.
Slightly north of Bex Pond and west of Bex Pond is level 2. So. But I believe our parcel, because there's a county parcel in between the pond and this property, we should be in that red area, level 1. Which is, of course, as everybody knows, targeted growth area. All right. Unless there's anything further, I'll have Mr. Sitaram make a few comments.
Go ahead.
Thank
you. Mr. Chairman, members of council, Dev Sitaram with Caverns and Associates, engineer for the project. Would you like me to respond to the questions Councilman Tackett had, or do you want me to just go over
briefly? No, go ahead. If he's not satisfied.
I can address these comments, and then I can go over other topics. The entrance to Salem Church Road, as Mr. Abbott indicated, we did have extensive conversations with DLDOT with regard to the location of the access on Salem Church Road, as well as the improvements along Salem Church Road that needed to be made to satisfy the site distance concerns that Councilman Tackett mentioned, as well as provide for safe access to the neighboring subdivisions. Because there are two roadways that are both one to the north and one to the south of the project. You'll see that on the handout, on the north side it's called DZ Drive. And on the south side, it's called Spruce Drive. These are driveways across the street. And we were the location of the access was important because, you know, there is, as Councilman Tackett indicated, there's concerns about vertical site distance, not only the vertical site distance, but also access into these neighborhoods, the existing neighborhoods. We had to make sure that we accommodated them. So one of the things that we did is we placed the entrance in the smack in the middle. You can see graphically it shows it pretty well in the middle of those two locations. And then additionally, we are widening Salem Church Road to provide for a left turn lane to Spruce Drive. There is a bypass lane at DZ Drive, so DLDOT was concerned that we provide adequate left turn storage so that any cars that are coming along southbound Salem Church Road are not going to, you know, rear end somebody that is sitting. Right now, they do not have a left turn lane. So we wanted to make sure, or DLDOT wanted to make sure that we had a storage, left turn storage lane at Spruce Drive, which is what we're proposing. We're widening Salem Church Road to provide for safe access to not only our subdivision, but also to the existing subdivision of Spruce Drive, which they do not have currently. So those are some of the improvements that we are making on Salem Church Road. And we also had to do a site distance analysis to show that there was adequate site distance from our access, both northbound and southbound on Salem Church Road. So that is in response to your comment number one as to the site distance concerns. And DLDOT did review our access improvements, our proposed access improvements, and they have signed off on the location of the access as well as the improvements that we are proposing to make at the intersection as well as along Salem Church Road. With regard to comment number two, the property itself is much higher, but as the property goes towards Muddy Run, it flattens out. And you can see quite a bit of wetlands that are along Muddy Run, which is the northern boundary line of this property. And the same is true on the other side, which is the subdivision of Cedar Farms. It is relatively flat, right adjacent and along Muddy Run, but then the elevation picks back up as you go further north. I do not know the specifics of where the issues were in Muddy Run, where there were drainage issues, but our the detailed drawings, I don't show the 100-year flood line on these drawings, on the exhibits that you have in front of you, but the plans, the record plan indicates a 100-year flood line that is along Muddy Run, which we have to stay far away from. And so we are much higher as far as the homes that are proposed in French Park itself. We're much higher, and we are not nowhere close to the floodplain of Muddy Run itself. Now, the other concern with regard to the issue may be, what are we doing with regard to stormwater management? And is that going to create a concern or create an additional burden on Muddy Run? As Mr. Abbott indicated, this property is 100 acres, or a little over 100 acres, and about 75%, 74 acres is going to be green. You can see all the green that we are preserving on this property. So, however, this is forested. Most of the areas that we are disturbing are forested, and we are converting that into impervious coverage and grass, which does create additional runoff. So yes, there is additional runoff from this property. And how are we managing that? We did a study of Muddy Run on the north side, and the drainage area that drains to Muddy Run at this point is 5,500 acres, so somewhere along that ballpark. And one of the concerns that the county wanted to have us look at is make sure that if we did any detention of stormwater facilities, which prolongs the time that it takes for our stormwater to drain out into Muddy Run, that it does not coincide with the water that is coming down from the 5,500 acres that is running along Muddy Run. So actually, we did get a waiver you know, based on plans that we submitted to the county and the studies that we did, we studied it two ways. We studied it without what is called quantity control and with quantity control. So we are taking care of the quality aspects of the stormwater. So we're cleaning the water that drains off of the parking areas and the driveways and before it is discharged back out into Muddy Run. However, we're not doing the quantity control. And the reason we're not, and we requested a waiver from the county, and we showed the numbers. We said, look, we can do both. We can do quantity control if you want us to, and we but it is better if we do not manage the quantity, because if we manage the quantity, we are holding the water back, and we're actually going to coincide with the flows that are coming along Muddy Run. So in this case, we are releasing the water from these quantity stormwater facilities, the green technology BMPs that we have. We have 9 bioretention areas, 1 bioswale, one wet pond on this property. So we're releasing the waters from the from these bioretention areas that drain into Muddy Run faster than the water that is coming down along from the higher reaches of the creek itself. So that was the waiver that we got on the northerly side. On the southerly side, we are draining into Beck's Pond. We are controlling both the quantity and the quality of the stormwater that drains into Beck's Pond and ultimately into Belltown Run. So that is, hopefully I responded to the concerns you may have with regard to Cedar Farms. I do not know all the specifics of the Cedar Farms flooding itself, so I can only respond to what we did and the studies that we did for Muddy Run. With regard to number 3, has there been any reports on sensitive areas? You can see the entrance into the property is over some isolated wetlands and a riparian buffer that is around the isolated wetlands. And we actually had to go to REPTAC as well as to the Board of Adjustment to fill the isolated wetlands. These are not jurisdictional wetlands that are regulated by the Army Corps. And these are wetlands that are regulated by Newcastle County Code and the riparian buffer that is around these isolated wetlands. So as part of that, we had to do a study, an environmental study, impacts assessment that we submitted to REPTAC and DNREC as part of a member of the board of the REPTAC. And we also had DNREC come and visit the site to look at if there were any endangered species. We have notes that are on the plan that require the filling of the wetlands to be done at a time that, you know, we don't have any sensitive or amphibious creatures that may be in these isolated wetlands. So there are notes on the plan that restrict when these disturbance of the wetlands will take place and when the filling of the wetlands will take place or when that roadway is going to be built. And there are guarantees also with respect to the planting that is going to be put back within the riparian buffer and monitoring of those over a 3-year time period and a minimum survival rate for any of the forestation or reforestation that we are going to do on this property. So I can tell you the particular note on the plan.
Mr. Sir,
it is note number 47.
We have a couple questions. Councilor Cartier?
Yes, mine aren't civil engineering questions as much as looking at the zoning and maybe, I mean, Rich wanted to address that. So this is NCPUD zoning.
Yes.
Can you just maybe talk a little bit about that?
It's one of the last remaining NCPUDs in Newcastle County.
So planned unit development?
Planned unit development concept. And County Council, when NCPUDs were popular, County Council is to review the exploratory plans and approve a concept that the developer then went forward and recorded sections of the project. Limestone Hills is a PUD. I believe Mosher Pike Creek is a PUD. So there are several PUDs that have gone through the process, but that zoning does not, other than existing mm-hmm. properties, you don't have any new projects.
Is that strictly a residential type zoning, or is there any commercial?
Some of the PUDs have commercial, like Limestone Hills, I know, has commercial sections within it. Yeah, offices.
There's a cover and part of land use. Actually, there are PUDs that are totally commercial, like the Christiana Hospital. And you're going to be seeing a revised plan for that probably next workshop. But you can have a PUD that's all commercial, you can have it that's all residential. They allow for a mixture of commercial or residential. This was originally approved back in 74 with commercial. It was revised out, I believe, in 87. There was another revision made later in 1999, which was subject to the litigation, so we're actually under the 1987 plan.
Okay. So what we're proposing here is a mix of residential units, apartments, and townhouses.
Yes, sir.
Certainly, a lot of people like need apartment rentals in Newcastle County. I mean, I know that that's probably one housing segment right now. It's most dynamic. And then the townhouse section is proximate to that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the rec area you're going to provide. What is that? Just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, the recreation area, we are not, at least the plan right now, does not provide a clubhouse because we did not, or right now, there is no builder that has been identified for the apartment project. We have left a green space that could take a club area, as well as right now it just shows a green play, just for play equipment and play area, without specifying exactly what that equipment or play area might be. So it's just a generic placeholder on the plan. When a builder is selected or when a builder moves in to build these apartments, I'm confident that clubhouse is one of the entities or amenities that that apartment owners would like to see within the project, but we do not want to commit somebody that wants to buy this project to a clubhouse or a size of a clubhouse, not knowing, you know, what that might be.
I guess my last question, is there a DART bus stop anywhere on Salem Church Road?
We will provide a pad at the entrance as part of the entrance improvements. I don't believe there is bus service on Salem Church Road right now. Mm-hmm. But Delta has asked us to have at least put a pad in there for future stops.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to ask the question on what Councilman Cartier brought up about the clubhouse. What I'm referring to on the clubhouse, is that just for the apartments or is that for everybody in the village here?
I would say it would probably be limited to the apartments. Because it would be an amenity for the folks that move into the apartment. I don't believe the townhouse is. I'm not. This is not a community that is or a clubhouse. First of all, I can't speak to whether there will be or will not be a clubhouse. So.
Well, I think the other thing, for the record, this is Richard Abb again. The other thing, this was kind of a hybrid that I mentioned at the outset, where. Because of the litigation, our argument was that the codes in effect in 1974 applied. The county's argument was it should be re-reviewed under UDC. But even if it was re-reviewed under the UDC, you only look at certain articles of the UDC, transportation and natural resources. So regardless, because it's a 1974 plan genesis, a lot of these other issues regarding active open space, playground, so forth, did not apply. And as Mr. Sitaram said, in order to maintain flexibility, we decided to go with the basic unit, dwelling unit proposal, not lot one, anything specific that we would have to be wed to. So that sort of explains why some of the issues are going to have to be decided later by whoever ultimately builds the project.
Okay, the only reason why I'm asking is because if the houses are built first and the apartments are done last, and the houses are going to be part of the use of clubhouse, are they going to be paying a fee ahead of time?
Now, again, there's no plan for a clubhouse, so as a result, there's no clubhouse maintenance assessment capability contained in the documents in terms of the maintenance declaration. In effect, the maintenance declaration just covers maintenance of any open space, which, based on this plan, will be very minimal because, as Mr. Sitaram mentioned, most of the open space area will be left in its natural state. The only areas that are going to be disturbed are those areas where you'll see either building, parking, or road footprints, and then obviously some areas for the utility, underground utility lines, will have to be disturbed as well. But other than that, a lot of this wooded area, if you drive by there, it's wooded. Some of the woods are 20 years old, some of them in the rear maybe 50 years old, but a lot of that, if not most of that woods, will still remain after it's completed. And that's as every plan that comes in, council members are aware there's a requirement under the code that you not disturb trees unless they're directly in the line of fire, so to speak, for the development improvements that have to be built. So it'll be sort of a forested area with high densities in the middle there along the spine of the primary drive, Burgundy Drive.
Councilman Powers?
Yeah, I got it. Couple questions, and just to go back to the recreational area, you know, you're saying to go to the people that are building the apartments and selling the apartments and townhouses, and where I have a real problem is they get promised something and it's not on here, and then they say, well, it was never in the original, but then the first thing they say is when the salesman sold them the townhouse or the apartment or condos, is there will be a clubhouse with a pool. When it comes out, it's a clubhouse with a tennis court, and that's, I don't like seeing it without something there for that reason. And you all don't have to put up with it, but we do later. The other thing is, this thing has no lines and grades, and has, I wish you would put the soil types, but you're building on the only thing you can build on there. Here's a piece of property that's wet, most of it. You're going through a whale wallow with a road right through the middle of it. And then you got steep slopes of almost 10 acres. Where are the steep slopes on here?
The steep slopes, Councilman, are in those gullies that are in between the packs of townhomes.
And that goes back to the Muddy Run on the north side.
So it's all on the north side.
But I mean, I just, you know, front by... So really, most of your open space, you could never do on anything on it anyway.
Yeah, most of the open space.
I mean, so an open space plan, that really, it's just woods. I mean, it's one thing I think Councilman Bell and I have said, when you have an open field with nothing wrong with it, and we're doing 50%, we ought to be looking at moving houses into there. But this is a piece, you couldn't, you know, it's great. It's a 50% open space, but you could never build on it anyway. But I just don't understand going as a farmer, and I got a few others in here, how can you go through a wetlands and fill it in? I mean, even we can't even do that anymore. It just, you know, the rules are different for everybody. I guess if you go to whatever you had said earlier to get a variance, I guess I can go to a variance to fill in a wetlands on my farm. What's the difference? Yeah. So that's the group that can say it's okay to go and fill it in.
Mr. Sitaram can probably comment on that further, but there's one provision in the code that talks about essential access.
Please state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, Richard Abbott. On behalf of the applicant, the The area where Burgundy Drive goes across the isolated wetland fronting on Salem Church Road is effectively the only access point that we could get, because it had to be situated in between the two roads, the two entrance roads on the other side, on the east side of Salem Church, which is Deasy Drive and Spruce. And again, that's per DelDOT. We couldn't line up the access. Obviously, DelDOT likes to see 90-degree angles. They'd love to see the entrance lined up with another entrance to another community, typically. But because we don't have frontage that's directly opposite either of those two entrance roads, DelDOT basically wanted it to be equidistant, right in the middle, in effect, between those two entrances. And so places you smack dab in the middle of the wetlands.
Your north corner's right up to that other entrance.
Yeah, Councilman.
You're right next to it.
Yeah, we did try that, Councilman Powers, and we couldn't fit the improvements that were necessary. We had to, go onto the neighboring property.
I'm just, I say a well, Alan, and somebody living in my area would say that. When you hear about Chesapeake Bays, that's a Chesapeake Bay right there. You're going right through the middle of it. And I just have a problem. If you're going to restrict me from going through them, everybody ought to be restricted.
Councilman Smiley.
Councilman Street was prior to me.
Okay. Whatever. Councilman Street?
Thank you. I understand. I don't have my glasses with me. I understand there are going to be some revisions to the entries on and some widening the road on Salem Church Road.
Yes, sir.
What about the rest of the road?
Rest of Salem Church Road, mm-hmm. They're talking about? We are not proposing any other improvements.
Well, was it any kind of traffic study done as relates to this?
This property, Councilman, is located within the Route 40 corridor study, and when the Route 40 corridor study does have the traffic generation, for a lot more units, I believe 688 units from this property, based on the plan, 1974 plan, I believe, that was prepared for this property. So the Route 40 corridor study does have the traffic generation from this project included within it. And as you know, the Route 40 corridor study is extensive. It targets certain improvements at certain intersections. So that was the understanding that we had with DelDOT, that we didn't have to, as long as we were part of that study, we were adequately covered.
You got understanding with the wetland people, understanding with DelDOT. My concern is this. According to your presentation, the apartment creates 700-some parking spaces. That's separate and apart from whatever the number of people who are going to be in the housing units. Now you're talking about dumping approximately 1,000 more vehicles out on the little teeny Salem Church Road. And y'all think that's acceptable and it's not going to have a negative impact on the community, then I would just suggest you, DelDOT, anybody else, go down there one night or one afternoon when Christiana Hospital is playing football. And all the folks that you're going to propose to live there, they're going to be 2 or 3 hours trying to get in and out of where they live. The other concern I have is 1974 study, that's the rules, but I don't know, and I'll have some questions from council. For council is how you go in a plan that's 40 years old and don't consider the buildup that's been done since that plan was approved 40 years ago. And, I'm not the councilman for the area. Obviously more familiar with his area than mine, but I know that I have folks that work with me who live in the area, and they have problems getting to and from work, especially at certain times of the year. And I know what happens, at least during football season,
and I don't quite frankly understand how traffic and that little road is not an issue and something that shouldn't be considered.
Thank you. These old code parcels, I thought we saw the last one when we had the Radisson decision, but I guess they hang around forever. I happened to sit in on an infamous Board of Adjustment hearing a couple decades ago, and even then, these were old code parcels. It is problematic. On the one hand, you have the equity of a property owner that purchased, relying upon the fact that he or she or it could build on it. On the other hand, you have the interest of society in not building on wetlands, and we raise the standards. Now, when the Board of Adjustment dealt with this in the Radisson case, they decided not to grant the variance. I intend to go read the rationale of the Board of Adjustment hearing before I vote on this. And I want to go back, and I should have had it here, to take a look at the planning board dealing with the Board of Adjustment. Was the planning board recommendation before or after the Board of Adjustment?
Was it we had a planning board recommendation on a plan? Right. It's not a rezone.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I'd like to take a look at the Board of Adjustment. If perhaps counsel for the applicant could talk a little bit about the Board of Adjustment decision, what was the rationale, how they dealt with this issue?
Well, there was a, sure, I'd be happy to. Richard Abbott, we had a extensive study as required by the UDC, so I'm not trying to say we did anything special, but the environmental impact assessment report that's required by the UDC was prepared by Landmark JCM. We went in the spring of 2011 to Rappahannock. As you may know, councilmen, there are 15 or 18 members of that advisory committee, many of whom are either engineers or involved in the environmental fields and very familiar with these subjects. In effect, the area, the isolated wetland areas are, number one, very small. Number two, almost everyone, with I think only one exception, do not really, were not found after multiple visits and inspections to actually contain any type of organisms other than microorganisms. In terms of animal habitat and everything, salamanders, they were found to be not conducive to that because many of them are technically wetlands because they're only wet part of the year. So again, that's vernal pools, as I recall, was the term that was used by our expert. And so Rappahannock agreed that because of the, not that all wetlands don't potentially provide habitat for microorganisms as well as flora, fauna, and wildlife, but were found to be of low quality, of low value in the scheme, you know, scale of 1 to 10, I don't know, you know, say a 2 in most instances. There were a few that had, that were found to have slightly better quality, but again, the small size of them and the magnitude of impact, because they were, there were multiple, and I could look in the assessment and see how many of them there are. So the total area sounds larger, but it's made up of so many smaller areas that Rappahannock felt it was appropriate with the types of mitigation. And all I can say about the Board of Adjustment is they tend to rely on the recommendation of Rappahannock. So we had a positive recommendation from Rappahannock with conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We had a positive recommendation from the Land Use Department.
And just a follow-up question, I will add to my reading list the RIPTAC recommendation as well. Could I ask, are these units, particularly the ones on the back wing, built on slabs? Because I'd be concerned about flooded basements if they weren't being built on slabs.
Dev Sitaram again. They're all built on slab. No, going with the comments that Councilman Powers had, yes, there, the water table is high on this property, as evidenced by the wetlands that are on the property. And because of that concern, the townhouses as well as the apartments will not have any basements. They will all be slab on grade.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions from Council? Councilman Taggart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, to just reiterate the fact of, you know, my past opposition to the plan and my current recusal of this, where we are today, lies in the fact of my history with this and where I was in the community. It has nothing to do with any relatives that I have associated with this or any financial interests at all that I would have in this plan. So that's not where it lies, just to be clear for the record. And then, hence, just quickly, a little history real fast again. Back then, my predecessor, Karen Vineski, went with Tommy Gordon down to Dover. Janet was down there at that point and used the state to propose legislation that passed. I think Viola was in it, too, but I'm not positive. Do you remember? I think it was, no, it was DeLuca and Oberle. But they proposed legislation that passed that allowed us to sunset the plans. The developer in this case has very deep pockets, you know, was able to keep the plan out there through suits for quite a long time. And I think the county probably spent upwards of $100,000 or so in attorney's fees and all. We think we kept most of it in-house, though. And I think ultimately it was a judge that decided it can go forward. And DelDOT broke, you know, and said, they came to the agreement and said, you know, we're going to agree to your entrances and we'll allow you to use your traffic number. So hence we're here for the approval.
Sounds accurate, other than just one little tweak was the judge said we're going to go to trial. In other words, the county had said we think we're right legally. The judge said maybe, but I'll see you after trial. And obviously, since it could go either way at trial, the county felt a compromise was appropriate. Just as a way of background, too, we did a rough calculation. If the plan, the 74 plan, had to be resubmitted again, it only gets reviewed under transportation and natural resource UDC requirements, no other requirements in any of the other articles of the UDC. We had estimated about 430, 435 units would result from that. Of course, the original plan had 688, and 511, I guess, if you, from our perspective, at least the county got the better end of the deal because we knocked off 170 and got about 80 more than we probably would have gotten if we had lost the litigation. So the county got two-thirds, we got one-third. So we wouldn't say it was a split of the difference, but it's a compromise nonetheless. So it's the total unit counts on the lower end of the 50-50 split, if you look at it that way.
Councilwoman?
Can I just have clarification? I guess this is probably Mr. Culbert. Is this for us, is this a ministerial vote or a discretionary vote?
This is a ministerial, but this is Record Bank compliance, and the bank complies with the county.
Thank you.
Any other questions from council? Councilor Cartier.
Understanding this is an old plan, old zone, gone through legal issues and so forth, just for the record, it does comply with the stormwater management codes that we currently have on the Unified Development Code, correct?
Yes, sir.
And it, what other standards of the Unified Development Code does it also meet?
All the environmental standards of the UDC Chapter 10.
All the environmental standards.
With the exception of the fill that we run to the Board of Adjustment.
Yeah, there's a variance.
And what... Can you comment on any other upgrades to conform to the Unified Development Code that are incorporated in this plan? You spoke about how the unit reduction came in as part of the settlement, but I wonder if you could just talk about upgrades to the plan.
Well,
if
the 688 unit plan had been approved, then number one, obviously, we would have proposed to fill a lot more UDC protected isolated wetlands because we wouldn't have had to comply with EPC. We would have had to respect federal jurisdictional wetlands because that's a separate law. But all of the isolated wetlands could be filled because obviously the 74 code didn't protect them. In addition, I think stormwater management would have been largely the same, and there would have been limited protection. Obviously, there would have been more wooded areas, forested areas that would have been impacted, because again, in 74, there was no forest protection provision. So basically, all the UDC-only protected natural resources, or a lot of them, would have been disturbed. In this instance, and if you look on the plan sheet that we handed out that Mr. Sideron prepared, you can actually see the percentages of natural resource compliance, which are riparian buffers 98.9%, floodplains 100%. So anyway, there's a lot of different natural resource items that would not have been protected to that anywhere near that degree in some instances under the 688-unit old plan.
Are you going to incorporate landscaping, comply with the Unified Development Code, all the landscaping requirements?
We'll be complying. All the roads will be complying with today's standards, DLDOT standards for sections of the paving that are required within the community. So the construction will all be compliant to today's standards. The houses, the homes, as well as the roadways, the utilities, infrastructure, will all be compliant.
The council, again, this is Richard Abbott. The gist of the settlement agreement was that we come forward, show the land use department, try to comply with 100% of UDC natural resource protection. If we could not, and still get the to get the 511 units, then we would sort of go over that and show them that it was relatively minor in terms of the deviations from the requirements. And then in that instance, we were required to go through the normal UDC process, which is to go to RPATIC, get the variance, and then provide mitigation, which includes, among other things, a 2-acre wetland mitigation replacement area. So there's really no net wetland loss when it's all said and done. Once that wetland mitigation area is built, it's actually larger than the amount of wetlands we're disturbing. So the net is actually on the positive to that degree. But technically, we're disturbing existing wetlands, so we've got to show that on the percentages the plan you have in front of you. Mm-hmm. So in the end, though, it's a virtually UDC-compliant natural resource protection plan, other than those small percentage exceptions you can see on that list. Right. Under the old plan, there were no impact fees related, those related fees. And so to that extent, the county gets a little extra boost in terms of its fiscal position.
Anything else from council?
That's what you'd have.
Any questions from the public?
All right.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Peggy Schultz, and I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Newcastle County. And we would certainly have questions about the wetlands, but I guess you folks are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place up here on the council. And but we know that the effects of climate change are upon us, and with climate change comes increasing intensity of storms. And so this problem is not going to, I mean, it's going to, we question whether it would continue to be a problem. And I suppose that there's a possibility that one day all of the people in the room will be sharing in the cost of buyouts here. I mean, it's not an easy situation that you all are faced with, but the League has a great interest in climate change. We have a great interest in natural resources, and of course, this situation appears to be a problem.
Yeah, imagine that. It's like a plateau.
Good luck.
Thank you. The soils will make the water. Anything else from the public?
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay, next we have resolution 13150. It has to do with Columbia Place at the Garden of Eden Road, and Councilman Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of council. This is 15.4 acres, which was rezoned from S to ST. The location is Garden of Eden Road, at south side of Garden of Eden and west of Concord Pike, east of Taunton Drive. We have a community that's represented by the Tavistock Eden Ridge Working Group. They've been diligently tracking through this matter since years before this matter came before council for its rezoning approval. It's now before us for record plan approval. And it has a positive recommendation from the Land Use Department, with the assent of council. I tabled this at our last council meeting to send this back to the Land Use Department for technical code compliance question, whether or not it complied with the drainage code. Received an answer from General Manager David Culver indicating that it did. I then referred three specific engineering slash legal questions to the Land Use Department for the attorney for the Land Use Department, Mary Jacobson, who on very short notice put together a detailed reply that's been furnished to Frank Madrick and to the applicant, Jerry Heisler. There's copies as well to distribute. The executive summary would be yes, the Land Use Department and the Law Department for Land Use agree that it is code compliant with the drainage code. And I appreciate the opportunity to allow council to look at the answers that have been put forward and to allow Mr. Madrick to ask questions and also for Mr. Heisler to have the opportunity to explain why he agrees with the Land Use Department and Law Department. And with that, I'll turn it over to the applicant, unless the chairman has anything else that he would prefer to do first.
Councilman, I wonder why, did you just get this? I mean, how come we didn't have this electronically and ahead of time?
We just got it.
Just came in?
Just came in.
Okay. Well, then thank you for getting it to
sure.
us.
Sure. The ink is still wet.
I have it for you electronically, Neil.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
Mr. Heisler?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of County Council, thank you for allowing me to speak today. First question, whether the plan was code compliant, the answer is yes. Actually, we exceed the stormwater requirements set forth in the UDC and the state. Three professional engineers, Drew Hayes and Bacamy, DENREC, and Newcastle County, reviewed this plan. It meets all the criteria and exceeds them, as I stated before. The second issues, which were easement issues, which were researched by Mary Jacobson, asked by Frank Madrick. From what I can tell, I'm not a lawyer, but they seem to make sense, and it says, as long as we don't exceed the drainage requirements of the present system that's in place now, not creating a burden, we're okay to use it. Additionally, the easements have been in place for years. The civic group has been contending it that we don't have a right to it. The real fact is, if we were not allowed to use these easements, 80% of the plans probably, and I'm just guessing, that have been passed, you know, recorded under the UDC would be null and void. So this is a matter of practicality and rational legal analysis. And if you need more legal opinion on it, I can get my lawyer to do something, but I would just like to get this plan recorded at this point. We comply with the code. The civic group keeps asking questions, and anyone has a right to ask questions, but at some point, we also have a right to get recorded. And if we should get tabled, again, I would ask that County Council President, if it's all right with you, take over that privilege to bring it forth at the meeting you're away, because I know I'm only allowed to be tabled twice, correct, under the code, and would like to be recorded then.
Right.
So I'd like to be done and not be here anymore. I think this has gone far enough. Thank you.
Any questions from council to the applicant?
One last thing. I offered the civic group, and this is public, if they were interested in me co-managing and co-payment any of the easement costs, I'd be happy to do that. There was no interest in that. They've never really repaired the easement. Some of the pipe is not in the greatest shape. We're not even using some parts of the easement, using our own pipe. So we're open-minded. We just need to have someone to dance with. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything from council to the applicant? Mr. Madrick?
Thank you. I'm Frank Madrick. I'm chair of the Tavistock Eden Ridge 3 working group, and like you, I just got the legal analysis. Now, I did bring some copies of the background and questions that we gave you at the last time, but if you pass some down, you probably did not bring them with you. Question, the phrasing is something code compliant? Covers a lot of information. There are a lot of different kinds of sections and aspects in the UDC and in the drainage code. And the only issue we're raising is the question, do easements exist, and were the easements obtained, and should the easements be obtained? Because in the drainage code, the first thing that catches one's eye is the definition of an easement. And what land use and the applicant have been saying is because an engineering drawing was prepared for a record plan back in 1971 that says this dotted line is the edge of the easement on the Tavistock side of the property line, that therefore this gives another party the full right to come in and use that easement without any agreements, without any conversations with the property owners. What hasn't been said is that when Woodlawn developed these properties, they sold the 15 acres to the pilot school with a deed restriction. And that deed restriction says that along that southern edge of the property where the church and the Y are now, and along Tavistock running from southeast to northwest, is a 10-foot drainage easement on the pilot school side of the property. That easement has never been used by the pilot school for drainage, and the applicant is not using that drainage easement for his Columbia Place project. Instead, what both the pilot school and the applicant are doing are cutting across their own easement and the property line into the Tavistock easement. The inference I draw from what Woodlawn trustees did there is all along, if you've ever had a chance to talk to Vernon Gordon or any of his predecessors like Hewlett Wood, there has been a plan for developing for residential purposes back away from 202 these properties. And Tavistock has been on that plan for a long time. There was another one across Garden of Eden Road called Rocky Run, not the village of Rocky Run, but Rocky Run. They later did not take that up. Instead, they sold off the northern part of it that became the village of Rocky Run behind the commercial buildings. And they sold off the bottom part of it, except for a strip, to the JCC. In scanning quickly through the legal opinion here, we're going to have to take a look at that. I can't make any comments or recommendations at all on that, but I did notice a couple of things that I started out by saying there's a definition for an easement. That definition is right at the beginning of what I've passed out there. And it's not been discussed by the applicant or county land use or by the attorney for legal. And that is, an easement is an agreement between two parties. And the practice apparently is that a record plan drawing that says easement strip takes away that requirement that anytime access is wanted, that the a party can just go and take it. But still, the drainage code in a number of places makes statements like the developer shall acquire, provide copies of, determine who's going to do the maintenance and such. And I won't try to cover all of those, but I still see a difference in the question we raised and the focus of the answers that we've been given. Do you have any questions?
Any questions from council? Councilman Weiner?
Yes, I just have a question of Mary Jacobson.
Go ahead.
Yes. Ms. Jacobson, is there any equitable doctrine which would explain why this definition of easement would apply to the applicant?
Well, I think there's two different issues that were raised. The first issue is the existence of the easement. And the easement was created not by a construction drawing or engineering drawing, but it was actually created on the Tavistock 2 record plan that was filed in 1971. So there actually is a legal document that creates the easement. The second issue is, does the applicant have a right to convey stormwater through the existing easement with the development of the Columbia Place plant? And the answer to that would be controlled by Delaware common law, which has adopted the reasonable use doctrine, which is an upstream property owner certainly has the right to convey stormwater through downhill properties if it doesn't adversely materially affect the downhill property owner. So Delaware law does address this. In this case, there's no adverse effect whatsoever because the flow is actually being regulated more efficiently and more effectively with the existence of best management practices, a wet pond. The release is going to be better regulated than it was. I went through and I looked at these plans. I looked at aerials from when the land was woods and farmland to where it's developed today. When the pilot school was developed in the 1960s, there were actually concrete culverts that directed stormwater through the pilot property onto the land that's now Tavistock. At that time, Woodland trustees owned both parcels. At one point, the pilot school was conveyed to the pilot school. Woodlawn maintained ownership of the Tavistock land. When Woodlawn came through and developed Tavistock, that is when Woodlawn created the easement, granting the right for the pilot parcel to discharge. It's pretty clear to me that the easements exist. They have been in use since the 1960s. There were improvements made with drainage on the pilot school where the flow is now better regulated. There was a plan that came through in, I think, 1991 or 1992 for the pilot school where the track was modified, the drainage was better managed again. There were some closed conveyance systems, additional closed conveyance systems added that channeled the water through the underground piping systems. So this is exactly how, when the courts look at drainage and stormwater management, this is exactly what the courts look for. What's the effect on the downhill property owner? Are you taking steps to control runoff so it doesn't adversely affect your downhill neighbors? That's what's happened through the years. And this is exactly how it should happen. So I don't necessarily see any issues whatsoever. I reviewed
Mr. Madrick's
questions. I think we've addressed them. And they've been resolved to the department's satisfaction and to Lowell's satisfaction.
I have a question for Councilman Powers.
Mary.
Thank you.
Kind of what was said between, you know, two parties. Honestly, the two parties, just understanding it, were the original two in 1960.
Right.
Now, you know, just, you know, I've been through easements. How long is this easement for?
That easement would be in perpetuity.
The same. So, really, what he brought up was exactly what was done, was there were two parties that did the easement that goes on forever. I mean, I preserved a farm, and it's forever. It goes to the next person that buys it. They have an easement on it. Can't build on it. So.
Well, I think an interesting aspect that was brought up was, you know, you need a document or you need two parties' approval for these. Actually, in the UDC now, if you look at the definition of subdivision, it includes the creation of drainage easements, sewer easements. So it is
the way it's done, you show these easements on a record plan, and actually that's what's required in the code.
And that's why I was just asking the question, is they go on forever. So.
They certainly do. As far as maintenance, now this was one issue that was brought up. Woodland owned both the properties, so when the pilot was discharging onto Tavistock to begin with, there was no need for an easement because it was joint ownership. When Tavistock was being created and the developer came in and put in the conveyance system, I haven't seen any type of maintenance agreement. Under the code that was in effect in 1969, the drainage code, the responsibility for maintenance of those private drainage systems on private property would be the property owner. There might be an equity, a fairness issue when you look at a situation today where these property owners are charged with the maintenance of maintaining this very large subdivision. You know, in my memo, I said maybe now is a good time, and Mr. Heisler has offered to adjust the maintenance responsibilities, and I think that would be a good idea, and maybe we would avoid some problems in the future if these pipes do fail or they do deteriorate, and they've been in the ground since the 70s, so it's likely to happen sooner rather than later. So we can't force that, the county can't force that, because under the 1960 code, it's a legal easement, maintenance responsibilities on the property owners, the Tavistock property owners. But it'd be a great time now, I think, to adjust the maintenance responsibilities.
I kind of know it through tax ditches, where we've had some areas at the time were not developed and were pretty flat and held the water up in the ditches below it. Well, now they have subdivisions that have a pipe in the town of Towns End going right in there, and none of the people living in the subdivision pay to maintain the ditch that runs through everybody else's property, because at the time it wasn't really adding anything to it. Today it is adding to it.
Right.
You know, but right. it's hard to come back and do anything after you've already done it.
It is. So I always try to take opportunities like this to
try to change
something. Suggest that we look forward at the future and how we can avoid problems.
Mary, could you hold up a minute, please? Councilwoman Kilpatrick has a question.
Thank you. I just wanted some clarification. When you talked about the underground pipes within Tavistock, are those pipes that you're talking about the Tavistock, were they private pipes, or does that drainage ultimately lead to the Del Dot stormwater drainage system underground?
Because that is not tied into the Del Dot system. It goes under, it goes under the road and discharges into lands of the state, which are essentially Brandywine Creek State Park.
Right.
So if there's a tie-in, I'm not sure if the new plans tie in to a Del Dot road system, but I know the way these closed pipes are, they go under the property along the back property line in the easement area, and then they drop across into the lands of the state.
Okay.
Now, I also want to clarify, there is a 10-foot easement that runs along the back of the pilot school site adjacent to
Tavistock.
Tavistock, thank you. Which essentially creates a 20-foot easement. That is shown on the Columbia Place plan. So I guess the representation that's not shown is inaccurate addition on that. So now it's a 20-foot, 10 on each, which is very common with plans.
Right.
Required to go down.
Thanks.
Councilman Cartier?
Yes, just looking and reviewing the paper submitted by the working group of Tavistock Eden Ridge, it seems that, you know, in that first paragraph they're talking about, citing chapters of 12 and 40 of the Unified Development Code, it's looking in this context and looking at our law, these seem to be directed at establishing new easement agreements.
That's correct.
Not addressing an old system with old history, legal agreements, old record plans, right? So, you know, what they're citing here is not really particularly the case that we're trying to deal with an existing easement.
That's correct. I think it was a good point to raise. Is this a viable easement? Does this easement legally exist? And I spent a lot of time looking at that because it's a legitimate question. But it does. It does. It's on the Tavis, on the 1971 Record Major Plan for Tavistock, so it's there. So we have to recognize it. It does exist, and under the laws that were in effect at the time, it was a valid and legal easement.
Councilman Weiner?
Yes. I want to thank the law department for and Mary for yeoman's job in a short period of time. And I just want to say, as we all do, our constituents deserve answers. And they got a legal memo. And I encourage the applicant to continue to extend goodwill to the community, to work together. And I encourage the community as well to work together with the applicant. And, of course, the community will have the opportunity to say something now if you'd like, Mr. Madrick. Or you can say something to the floor of council if you'd like to. You may want to do some research and consulting with your group.
Mr. Heisler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I get recorded next week? Can I get recorded next week? Is that possible?
You mean as in here or record your plan?
For my plan, can it get approved next week or will it be tabled again? Do you think?
According to council, I don't have any reason why that the council can say anything. The only one would be the sponsor. Mm-hmm. He can ask to have a table. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be tabled, but he can ask to have a table, and that would be up to the council to say yes or no.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Weiner, do you have an indication what you will do?
My present intention is to bring it for a vote. Next Tuesday.
If you should go away, would it be possible to have County Council President
sponsor it
so it can be approved when you're away?
Well, my first, having said that, my present intent is that it come up for a vote on the 11th. Having said that, if for some reason, which I don't foresee, that it doesn't come up for the vote for the 7th, I would be happy to transfer management to the President of Council for that purpose. Because I would be away the next council meeting.
I think that would be good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I like to, Mr. Marshall, while you're standing, I'd like to ask you a question. In this easement, going back and forth, have you talked to Tavistock with this easement prior to where we're at today?
Yes. We've had a number of conversations. In fact, we had 3 conversations with the county executive and the chief administrative officer. Mr. Coleman was there. This has been going on for a little while. And it's just a matter of 2 different opinions, and to say the least, I've been very frustrated by it. But I think we have a clear direction we're going in now, and all the county parties in the county have spoken.
And this paper that came out of the law department is very enlightening.
Yes, it is.
You know, what really transpired on this. And I believe Mr. Madrick had his hand up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Kilpatrick had asked the question about does this tie into Delgado at all? It does. The underground drainage line that you can see up in the upper left-hand corner there ties into an Delgado drainage from Taunton Road in the circle area in the back of Tavistock, if you remember where that is. There's a catch basin there on the Tavistock side of the park that ties them all together, and then a larger pipe goes into the park. So it's taking part of the Delgado Street from Severn Road and from Taunton, as well as these here.
Thank you.
I don't really know why you were asking, but just wanted to let you know.
But just kind of the continuum of the system. I mean, I kind of remembered that we had done some areas back in there, so thank you.
Anything else from council? Anything from the public on this matter? Okay, moving on.
Thank you.
Okay, this is a discussion that is an ordinance that 13040, and it has to do with Newcastle County Code Chapter General Provisions and Chapter 2 Administrative, and to create a new chapter 29 of Agriculture. Councilman Powers, Councilman Bell, and Councilman Weiner sponsors.
Who wants to take it?
Yes, I will.
All right.
I know I tabled it because there were some people that were saying they had some questions. And
yes.
Hopefully we have enough people here to answer them.
Okay, anybody on council want to ask questions about 040? Council Weiner.
Just a comment and a question I've already discussed with Marlene. I signed on as a co-sponsor, and I've had a chance to read it through carefully a couple times, and there have been some really good changes with the guidance of Ms. White and all the co-sponsors and the County Executive Administration working together. I had, just for record, I had asked a co-sponsor and I both share one concern. Ms. White will review it to make sure that there is authority on the part of the fiduciary body to promulgate its own rules. And I don't know if Marlene's had a chance to look at that yet. I should have reviewed it beforehand, but I didn't.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I looked at it really quickly, Marlene White, Newcastle County Law Department.
State your name loud.
Oh, louder? I can talk a little
louder. So we can hear.
Marlene White, Newcastle County Department of Law, one of the attorneys assigned to land use. Under proposed section 2902-102, authority of the trust, subsection G, it says the trust shall have those powers necessary and incidental to the effective operation management of the farmland preservation program and not otherwise prohibited by law. That's a vast or broad grant, which I believe would allow the trust to promulgate rules and regulations for the program. Also, for the program itself. We can delineate further if the sponsors desire to amend it so that's specifically spelled out, but I do believe that's a broad enough grant that will handle that. And then under section 2902-103, the duties of the trust, subsection A, it states that the trust shall make such rules and regulations as it deems necessary for the efficient and prudent operation and administration of the trust.
I knew we had it.
We
went over that. Yes. I'm now remembering.
Yes.
You're happy with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Councilor Smiley.
Clarify for me, and I guess it'll be Ms. White or one of the sponsors. If created as outlined here in this ordinance, is there any government entity, county executive, county council, whatever, that has any type of oversight, responsibility or authority over what would be the Newcastle County Farmland Preservation Trust? I mean, the way I read this, it appears as if we're basically creating a completely independent entity as far as creating its own rules, its own guidelines. It's actually directing the Department of Finance, Department of Land Use, and I just am I. Is that what this does?
It's got to be one.
Well, I can.
I'll
speak to part of that.
Okay.
My Councilman Powers. This trust is created akin to the pension trust. So it's not an independent foundation like as created the Agricultural Foundation is for the state. That has its own seal.
Right.
It can be sued. It's an independent entity. It's a whole. Totally independent entity. This is more akin to the pension trust. It's still a county entity, but operates independently of council and county executive. Like you wouldn't, the council and the county executive, as I understand this, would not direct the trust what to do. The trust would be created to have the best minds, experience, for in regard to farmland, so and farming practices, so that they could identify what would be the best farmland to preserve. So your expertise would be in the trust in order to effectuate the program. Is that your understanding of it, Councilman Powers?
Yeah, and really, when we looked at this, we looked at the Open Space Council and the State Farmland Preservation. So a lot of the stuff when they were reviewing it, was revealing from what how the state is operating their found, you know, their trust and foundation.
So, as to whomever, as you said, somewhat of a quasi entity of the county. So, they would still be subject to FOIA. If I had questions about their expenditures, their funding, whatever, I would have a right under FOIA, as anyone else would, to request documents, supports, and
yes.
Like I could to pension board.
Yes. Under duties of the trust, 2902.103, subsection B, if you look at that, that reflects the public meeting requirements under the state FOIA. There's also subsection C. It's very similar to the existing requirement in the code that requires a yearly report by all boards, committees, and
commissions.
Thank you, Councilman Weiner. To provide an annual report to the county executive, county council. However, this, if you look there, this is a we have more specific reporting requirements for the period that the trust will have to say what the farmland preserved was, including acreage, the method of preservation. So whether it was by transfer development rights or conservation easement, a financial accounting of the farmland preservation fund, including their expenditures and income sources. And we did leave the open-ended third section part there, such other information deemed appropriate. And that can be ferreted out over time because this is a new program running. There'll be things that we don't contemplate now that'll come to the board, the trust attention, that may need to be addressed at a later time.
Okay, just one more follow-up, if I can. Mr. Chairman, pension board, ethics commission, two very independent bodies of county government. But if they want to make changes in the rules, procedures, they're brought before council in legislative form. Is that the same here? I don't read it that way.
I don't think that's the same here.
Okay, I didn't read it that way. They're basically totally independent bodies for us. So if they want to change a rule or process or something, that's totally up to them. Council has no council, the exec, no one has any. I mean, the public has oversight naturally, and we can look, but we're not part of the approval process in that.
Right, once it's established that the subsection G we were talking about previously, that having the powers necessary and incidental to affect operation management of the program and not prohibited by law, that is a pretty broad grant.
Right, and this also grants them full autonomy on any contracts, arrangements, agreements to purchase or farmland. Council would not have an approval in that process either, correct?
I think that's correct, but there are limitations. If you get back to under authority of the trust, certain issues as to what can and can't be. Right, the board shall work with the Department of Land Use to ensure that parcels acquired would not be otherwise protected by the county, that parcels aren't acquired or to be acquired by as parkland, or that there are not parcels that are preserved or designated for preservation as open space as part of a plan of development. So there are requirements throughout the text of this proposal that put strictures.
And those are kind of guidelines as to what their guidelines would be when they adopt. They would prohibit being able to purchase land for those certain projects, which would fall under county purview and other lines like parkland. I mean, that's
right.
Yeah. So okay, I understand. Okay. So thank you very much.
The way I see some of this here, now I'm all for preservation, but the way that is here, it's written, the board is telling our finance department what to do. That's the way I read it. I could be reading it wrong now. And the other is, you know, they're picking either they get paid up front or they get paid over a period of time. And, you know, I think with Newcastle County's money, which belongs to the public, I think it should be paid over a period of time. And the reason why I say it is because on a personal matter, there was a farm up on Wilson Road, and that was a Barch farm, which I'm a part of that family. And they were paid over a period of 10 years, which was only 6 point some acres. There was two brothers involved. And with that, they got paid in 10 years. And they got paid a pretty good sum of money within that 10 years. So I'm not saying that this couldn't be a good sum of money that some of these farms have, but I think they ought to be, I think one thing on here, and I think it should be paid in a period of 10 years over time. Because even though there can be a bond required for this to pay them, they still can be paid over 10 years. Councilman Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that, you know, and I'm certainly not a lawyer, but I think when you really read this through, the distrust and the folks that will manage it, okay, are held to a pretty high fiduciary responsibility. And if you read it, and I think to place a prerequisite on them that the way they distribute or the way they manage the farmland preservation in the future, that it would have to be spread out by 10 years would be wrong, because the very nature of their responsibilities are to decide on the amount of funding that is available, both from county, both from state, federal, and private entities, and to take a look at the different areas and the programs and what may be considered more environmentally sensitive and everything, and to determine, you know, in what pecking order things are done, and to how much it should be spread over. To say arbitrarily 10 years, the trust may come back and say that a particular area or a particular part of the trust may take a 3 or 4 or 5 year program in order to accomplish a certain segment of farmland preservation. And like I say, I'm certainly not a lawyer, but I think that the allowing the trust, the members of the trust, to, under the way this is written legally, to manage it, they're going to be held accountable. No matter what anyone says, they're still held accountable to the government and to the citizens of the county as far as the way they manage this and the way it's done. And that's what I understand of it, and I think the flexibility is borne on the members of the trust to regulate it by what's the availability of funding and what part of the program, where they're at in a particular part of the program. So I guess that's the way I read it.
Yeah, and
if I may, sure. I'll echo Councilman Bell's comments. In subsection, it's 2902.102, the authority of the trust. If you go to subsection C, it's does say that they can, example, you can, they will, the trust can utilize bond issuance arrangement providing the tax grantor's payments to property owner for a period of years to maximize the available resources. It's all,
right.
As a whole, the legislation is written to maximize the ability of the trust to go out and get, preserve as much farmland as possible and preserve their resources for as long as possible to accomplish that goal. But unless, it reads further, unless the owner of a high priority parcel, acquisition of which is critical to the program, refuses to sell the development rights or easement without full payment at the time of purchase. You know, the trust could encounter an incident where they've identified, say, the most critical farm to be preserved, and the owner may not have you over a barrel, but realizes the importance of that parcel and may not wish to wait for a segment serial payment as opposed to one lump sum payment. I don't expect those things to happen because I think the general course of these programs, and I can tell you what it's like in various states that I've looked at when we were researching this, it is over a period of time. There are some that have lump sums, but I think the idea, from my understanding, Councilman Powers and Weiner can speak more to the intent of it, is to provide that time payment option as the main option, but have the contingency in case there is a critical piece that, you know, is identified and they really want to, this is one we need to save, but the owner won't budge unless we give full payment, just to have that flexibility in there for those probably uncommon occurrences, but those, that could happen.
Councilwoman?
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. When you go to the members in the terms, the established members in terms, if I'm reading this correctly, we can have four people as a quorum. One of those people could have a conflict of interest, but they're still counted as a quorum, so they then can't vote. So we could have two members of this board making decisions, which concerns me a little bit. I mean, there's eight members of the board to begin with, which is not a lot, and going, you know, down to two actually making a position, making a decision on things, concerns me. When we talk about bonds, understanding that for every $1 million, our payback is $80,000 a year, per year. If we buy this land with bonds, it's not the trust's responsibility to pay this back, it's the county's, or is it the trust's responsibility?
Well, let me answer your first question.
Okay.
About the quorum, and we'll go back to the beginning of that. It's eight members that could be amended if the sponsors would like to amend that.
Well, seven of them.
Well, it says consists
of
eight.
Non-voting member.
There's a non-voting member.
And it says four shall be a quorum.
Yeah.
Right, because the fact...
It's seven voting members.
Because the Department of Land Use General Manager is appointed by the county executive, and
right,
that person serves at the county executive's pleasure, we felt that that, in speaking with the sponsors, we felt that that person didn't need to be a voting member.
Okay, so we have basically seven members.
Seven members.
Still
that are
two
voting
can make a decision.
So if you have four trustees for your quorum, it could be two, as you're saying.
Yes, which
I... just because we've taken Section E, just to give a little bit of light on this, from essentially taken that section from the state code to avoid conflict of interest as much as possible. So taking our guidance from the state code, it does reduce the quorum. And one of the problems that the county experiences repeatedly with all boards is getting enough members to fill it. Whether it's License Inspection Review Board, Pension Board, HRB, it's just, I think if you get too broad a membership in your board, you may not be able to fill the amount of space that's necessary.
And I agree with that. My issue is with two people being allowed to make a decision on whatever happens to be there, be in front of them. Then my next one is, who's responsible for paying the bonds back, Newcastle County or the board? Do they have, the trustees, do they have to have the money in hand prior in order to know that they have the ability to pay it back, or does it fall back on Newcastle County?
Let me look that over if you'll give me a few minutes to...
Okay, well, I have more questions if you want to...
Okay.
The seed, I'm presuming Newcastle County is putting seed money into this. Is that the $3 million that was just approved through the bond?
That I'm going to defer to the council members that were at the council meeting last week. That I can't speak to.
Okay.
I mean, the three million that goes with state money to purchase some in Port Penn Corridor,
mm-hmm,
all the TDRs, the development rates, whatever we want to say,
right,
come to us.
Correct.
So whatever other TDRs the county, which they already own, off of some they've already done, would put, go in if they want to do a bank, and that would go start the bank.
Right, but my Mine isn't about TDRs. It's about...
Councilwoman, are you going to ask the lawyer? Or
well, I just, I have, I just have several questions. I mean, I can continue to go through my questions and somebody can give me an answer or...
Right.
I mean, I'm not talking about TDRs. Right. I'm talking about actual dollars here.
Okay.
The seed money for this trust. I want to know where the actual dollars come from to start the trust.
It wouldn't be...
Okay. Hold on, Mr. Councilman. Okay. Marlene, do you want to answer this?
That I can't answer. I can't tell. I don't...
We have got to that point.
Actually, what Councilman Powers stated, as far as the enabling legislation, I can answer most of those questions for you, but actual seed money, that I can't answer for you at this point.
Okay.
You can answer it.
I have a couple more.
Go ahead.
All right. When you talk about the duties of the trust and you talk about shall hold regular meetings, there's nothing that defines when that what regular means. Once a year, once a quarter, once a month.
That can be amended if the council sponsors wish to delineate that more particularly.
When you talk about conservation easements, you talk about acquisition of development rights or conservation easements. If it's a conservation, my understanding was that if we are buying, if this is farmland preservation, but now we also have the ability to take these and put them into conservation easements, does that mean that the land bought for conservation easements does not have to be farmed?
No. My understanding of the legislation, the purpose of this legislation is to maintain the land that's preserved, whether it's by any of the delineated methods, is to keep the land in active farming. And the reason there are a broad number of methods to do that is to, because we can't contemplate every instance that's going to come up now, to give the trust the flexibility to deal with each case as it comes to the trust to preserve.
Okay. My next question is about taxes. If we buy a farm preservation, TDR, conservation easement, are we subdividing out the building areas that those will still be subject to Newcastle County real estate tax?
You mean like the residential buildings that are carved out currently in the code?
Correct.
That wasn't contemplated in here. That can be addressed, I think. It can be addressed in here, although I think it would be better to address it once the program is up and running.
Well, I tend to find that those things don't get addressed if we do them after the fact. So, I mean, if we're buying the farms, we're buying actually the farm land. So if we're still, are we, there would be no TDR going with the building, correct?
If I can answer that, for a regular, David Carver, Department of Land Use, for a farm today under the exemptions, and once you get your ag exemption, the homestead is carved out separately. So your ag exemption is on the farm. Normally it's an acre and a half, depending on the size of the unit, that's carved out separately, that's given the full assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So on any preserved parcel, if they're allowed to keep, you know, say, three or four rights for family members, if those lots are later subdivided off from the farm, they would be subject to the regular taxation of Newcastle County, and that acreage would be deducted from the farmland assessment that would then be reduced accordingly by those houses cut off. So that's how we do it currently. This would not change that. If on any preserved farm today, we still will draw an area, assessment will draw an area around that structure, which is assessed as a normal residential structure. It's the farmland itself that's not assessed.
Okay.
And that's as long as they meet the criteria of the state code, which is $1,000 for 10 acres.
Okay. The establishment of a fund, are we committing to put something in from Newcastle County on an annual basis? So it just says they establish the Farmland Preservation Fund, which shall be referred to as Farmland Preservation Fund. I mean, understanding that the trust is a nonprofit, that they would have the ability to make, request money, go to, for grants, whatever. Are we, by creating this fund, are we committing to an annual assessment for this?
I don't believe so. There's nothing in this legislation that commits the county to putting in a specific amount every year.
Okay.
You can't bind the future councils.
My other question was in the enforcement of the restrictions. Mm-hmm. When it talks about in 2902.401B, the county on behalf of the trust shall be entitled to take action in any court of competent jurisdiction to enforce any restrictions or requirements imposed under this chapter, duly adopted ordinances, and binding legal instruments. In any such action, the county shall, if it prevails, be entitled to recover its reasonable costs and expenses, including reasonable attorney fees. But if the land is no longer being farmed, which was the criteria of the preservation, do we have any recourse in recovering the purchase and or of the TDRs that we purchased?
We could add that specific language to the proposed legislation if the sponsors wish to amend it so. We left it open to take the matter to court as opposed to having it right in there paid back. But that's certainly something we can...
Okay, but it doesn't say... Well, I mean, so you're entitled to take action in any court.
Right.
Okay, so... But then it says that you can recover reasonable costs and expenses, including attorney's fees. So where it says take action in any court, that would be to get the money back from that we paid out.
To either enforce or to recover the money. And then on top of what's recovered, to get our expenses and attorney's fees that are expended in order to engage in that enforcement action.
Okay.
And one of the things about this is the county will have to do it on behalf of the trust because this trust is different from the state foundation. The state foundation, as I said before to Councilman Smiley, is a truly independent entity. It has its own seal. And the enabling legislation in Title III of the Delaware Code lists all those things that make it into a totally independent entity, like its own seal, able to sue and be sued independently. We're not permitted to do that as the county for this foundation or for this program. So that's why we have this in there, that the county goes ahead and does that for the trust.
Okay.
And we did leave it open a little bit more broad than just recovering the amount paid. That can be a double-edged sword. If you just go after the amount paid and you're done, you know, that's it. Here it gives us a little bit more latitude to say, well, you can enforce it. Can we have specific performance where you actually keep it a farm? You're not doing X, Y, or Z under the easement, let's say. We're going to get it enforced in equity. Or we could go and try to recover the amount paid and then all expenses related to doing that enforcement action.
Okay. I'm very close to being done.
Okay.
I can imagine in Section 5 of 401 that when you're talking about a consultant to get this up and running with no bid, that there are going to be people on this council that are going to have some heartburn over that. And my last one is when you talk about retaining services of full or part-time person.
Section 6?
Section, yes.
Okay.
Who's paying for that? Is that one of our, is that a county person? Is that one of our vacancies? Is it a new person that would be added, or is it somebody that the trust pays for?
It says for Section 5, the consultant is to be paid from funds allocated to farmland preservation. That's
right.
General.
That my question or my comment there was the no bid thing, not necessarily the pay. But then in Section 6, where it talks about that the Department of Land Use, I guess, gets to decide whether they're going to retain the services of a person, a part-time or full-time person in the future. Is land use getting a new person? Are we taking a person that already has a job within the Department of Land Use and allocating the resources to this trust? And is there, are there going to be cross charges where the trust then would be paying for this person, or is the county in general paying for the person?
Well, Section 6 says that the person that we're talking about, the part-time services, would be, is land use is authorized to pay from the funds designated for farmland preservation, which would be funds from the trust for the part-time services and as an assistant. Whether that is an open position that's filled or a temporary position created to help the trust get moving, that I can't answer for you. That can be clarified in that section, but I'm not sure exactly how that employee would be characterized.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it. Councilor Powers?
I may go a little backwards here. You were saying farming. I think part of what really would be sued, if they stopped farming it, it would turn into forest, and that still would be under an ag. It's still preserved. Where the problem would be is if they built something on the property that shouldn't be built there. That is one thing. The, you know, I have no problems meeting quarterly to put in there.
A minimum.
Yeah, a minimum of minimum four of times a year. A quorum, you brought up a good thing. Mm-hmm. If we go to five, I have no problems.
All the co-sponsors concur in these answers.
Yeah. I do want to bring up the payment in time, and partly sitting on the Open Space Council as long as they did. What you'll find, and that might have been how theirs was purchased, they may have wanted it over 10 years. And I don't know, but I know when we did a lot of stuff, it depends. There's a lot of people that did not want the money all at one lump sum, and they wanted it paid over so many years. The problem is a lot of programs, I think even the state at one time, was not until they amended it that it had to be paid all up front. So then they changed it that it could be over time. So we were just trying to leave. You'll probably find more wanting to get paid over time just for the tax liability than they will having it as a lump sum.
I think it'd be better for both parties.
But it's, you know, somebody may have a situation where they owe a bunch of money and they got to figure out how to pay them. But that would be one thing. I wrote down a few of the things you said. But, you know, I can tell you, though, ag, and where we ran into it is when we changed the state farmland assessment and returners' properties were not being farmed, and at Christiana Mall, that's why we went to the 10-year, and I was involved because I was in the Farm Bureau, farmland assessment, and what they came back with, where they grew, let those properties grow up, is they got a forestry plan saying they were turning into forest and they were allowed to keep it as farmland assessed. And that was the property they're building on right now. So you're not really going to see that. Where it would be is something was done wrong on the property as development, then it would be. Okay. Once it's forever, it's formed.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Councilor Weiner.
Thank you. I'm going back a few questions. First, I wanted to just comment on some of Marlene's comments. A fiduciary board will develop its own rules and regulations, promulgate them as it sees its needs over time. The only equivalent we have is the pension board, which does have fiduciary duty. These board members, for example, on the pension board, can't delegate their fiduciary duty. That's one of the things that the pension board sort of learned again recently. It'll be the same with these. There's expertise that's going to be required, a diversity of interests, including some of the foundations that'll be represented on this. And the hand of any council can't control into the future what future councils can do in terms of allocation of funds. I just wanted to stress that point. I also wanted to talk about various scenarios because I've done some trusts and estate work. You can't anticipate what the needs are or demands of any particular situation. So to have an arbitrary non arbitrary rule of just 10 years buyout would, you don't want to lose your flexibility. Sometimes there may be an estate scenario where there needs to be a payout at a particular period of time in a shortened period or all at once because they're facing inheritance and estate taxes, particularly on the sale of a large farm. On the Barsh case on Wilson Farm, actually I was involved in that litigation. It was, rather than two brothers, it was the brother and the mother, and the...
she turned it over to the brother.
Yeah, but initially it was the brother and the mother, and whereas the one family member wanted the payout right away, the other family member wasn't happy with the buyout price, and after future negotiations, that family member was happy with the buyout price, but they wanted to extend it over time. But each of those were specific to that particular instance, and you wouldn't want to tie the hands of a fiduciaries in this trust to that particular scenario.
Councilman Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we answered as far as the quarterly and also the quorum. But the other thing, as far as the budgetary portion of it, the success of this program will be benchmarked as to how this board, this trust, succeeds. And with that being said, is that we've approved $3 million, okay, that's available for farmland preservation, okay, in this upcoming budget. However, any future funding, okay, would be have to be presented by the trust through the administration and put in the budget as a recommendation for this council. There's no commitment for future funds, automatic commitment. It would have to come before this council for its review. And like I said, I think that it's all going to be benchmarked on how successful the program is occurring. What type of state commitment that we have, what type of federal funds, what type of private foundations and commitments are being made. And, you know, so I think that as this thing evolves, it has a high probability of succeeding into a very beneficial program, but it's going to be dependent upon this trust, this board that will manage this trust, its reporting back to this council, and its endeavors as far as trying to seek external funding prior to this council approving any supportive funding or any further seed money to what's available to support it. So.
Councilman Cartier?
Yes. I mean, just forgive the naivete of my question here, but what, as far as farmland preservation, what is the value of going this strategy of creating a trust to do farmland preservation? Is there a real advantageous situation created with the creation of a trust fund? If we were to have a program strictly within the county that would address this?
Well, I'll address that briefly, and I think Councilman Powers, Weiner, and Bell would like to probably have some insight on that as well. Is that I believe there was previously a program of a certain type set up with Newcastle County in 2002 to 2004, and that program, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Councilman, was all extinguished by neglect, if you will. It wasn't set up to perpetuate preservation of farmland, where the trust and the fund would be set up to be perpetual, like the pension trust and pension fund, to continue. That's why we have the aspects of private loans, private gifts, to enable the fund or the trust to take advantage of all possible sources of income to keep the program and the fund going.
So this would be tax advantaged for donors because it would have incorporated on a nonprofit charitable basis, or is there?
It could be. We didn't want to get into laying out. I'm sorry.
Oh, I said we want to set it up that way.
Right. Yeah, we got another question coming from another councilman. So
I was going to say that would be a further step in the process. We need to enable it and create it first, yes. And then we can take that next step of the tax structure, if you will. Also, the state program, my understanding of it here in Delaware is problematic because it has farmers bidding, underbidding each other. So you have in areas that are less subject to high development pressures like Newcastle County, their farmers in those areas are able to underbid Newcastle County farmers because the development pressure isn't as great. And we're tending to... did you have a question?
No, I did, but I can't.
Oh, okay, I apologize. but this, because our it's not beneficial in many cases for a Newcastle County farmer to underbid so greatly that it, in the face of an offer from a developer.
Right.
So that's in order to counteract those pressures.
Okay. Mr. Carr, you see another?
Yes. Going under the section 29.02.102, authority to trust section C, talks about the trust may utilize a bond issuance arrangement to provide taxable interest payments.
Right.
Then the final, toward the end, the Office of Finance shall be assist the trust in arrangements for issuance of bonds. Is the trust going to have some kind of, like, I'm familiar with fire companies and another type of bonding authority, which is called conduit bonding authority. Is the trust going to issue bonds on its own, or are they going to rely on our bonding authority conveying those funds to the trust for preservation of farmland?
If I may, and I, Councilman Powers may be able to speak to this a little bit, perhaps, but... again, with this initial legislation, it's to give the broadest possible options for creating it. Operationally, as it gets up and running, what is the optimal method for the trust to acquire and utilize its funds? I can't tell you at this moment what that will be. But the idea behind the legislation is to give the trust broad ability to effectuate the purpose of preserving farmland. So that, I think, is one of those things that may have to be wrestled with as the trust is beginning its operations.
Councilman Smiley?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to retain my right to ask my question, but yes. Right now I'd like to yield to Councilman Weiner so he could address, as a sponsor, so he could address Councilman Cartier's question while it's fresh on the table.
Thank you. Thank you. I think that's a good way to proceed. That's why I was having a hard time remembering three speakers' questions back. But I'd like to address Councilman Cartier's question by adding just some elaboration on Marlene's point, and that is that with a transfer development rights bank, you create a revolving fund, in essence, which enables you to act quickly because it's sustaining when opportunities come up and we need to compete against development pressures. And that's what the most successful TDR programs in the country have done.
And they use farmland preservation trusts as a way to make that, effectuate that?
Yeah, oh, there's different models, but the 20 most successful in the country, they've used trusts. And the other follow-up point I wanted to say was, and because there were so many questions from Councilwoman Kilpatrick, if she could put them in writing, I think she really had some good, valid points, but all of us were having a hard time because they were coming like bullets. If you could put them in writing.
And I can put them in writing, that's,
yes. Great, thank you.
Councilor Smiley?
Well, I'm going to ask that Ms. Roberts put mine in writing so people can read them. But understanding I'm not an attorney and I'm not trying to undermine anything, I have five things I'd like to address. First off, and I had discussed this or mentioned it during budget talks, and it was triggered by conversation here, the discussion of the $3 million that was just authorized in the FY14 budget. The $3 million that we authorized is for land preservation. Understanding that includes farmland preservation. What I would strongly suggest, request, whatever way it needs to be, I think law needs to take a look at. We approved it for land preservation.
Acquisition.
If the purpose or intent will be to take all or part of that and transfer that to a new county entity that we're creating, be it a subdivision or whatever, I question whether that can be done without ordinance and council's action.
because it's not specifically going to what the budget directed to. Not saying it won't happen. I'm just saying let's just try to make sure it's right Counselor, going out.
Counselor, can I just ask a question? Are you saying the total of the three or a portion
any portion if it's not going directly to the land acquisition and it's going to the newly created entity for them to use it for farmland preservation, I think that's what we need to look at. Let's make sure that the money moves through government the way it legally should.
Yeah, point of information. Point of information.
Okay.
Thank you. Since we got five questions coming up, and both Marlene and the sponsors may have a response, I just request respectfully that we be able to deal with that question one at a time so that sponsor and Marlene can talk about it.
Marlene, you want to answer that?
Well, I can answer.
I'll yield to Councilman.
Because it doesn't, when she talks, I can't get her in there. But not meaning nothing with you. But I mean, it's totally would have to be a program that we would bring before saying starting a payment in lieu of or TDR program, because that's how you would use the TDRs to add density. So when they buy the TDR, it would go in the bank. So we're way ahead of this. Is just enabling it to come back and do exactly what you said.
I think maybe you lost me. All I'm saying is
it would have to be an ordinance that would
move it would into
spell,
the trust.
It would spell yes, it would.
That's what I'm.
And that's a, that would be exactly. This is not doing that.
No, I know it's not.
This we would have to.
I think what Councilman Smiley is referring to.
I think we're on the same page.
It's almost like a line item to where you designate X amount of dollars for X amount of programs.
But I know this doesn't do that, but the $3 million came up, so I just wanted to make sure I'm on the right track. The other thing to follow up with Councilwoman Kilpatrick as to if it's farmland acquisition, farmland preservation, should it remain farmland? I know Councilman Power said if they didn't farm it and it returned to woodland, it would still be agriculture. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think it should be designated that if it's farmland preservation, it has to remain farmland. Part of what I heard during discussions during the budget and earlier partial discussions on this was no farmers, no food. If that's the way we feel, then let's make sure if it's going in there that it's going to remain farmed. Or that means that they've defaulted on the program and whatever the process is.
Yeah. Your point of information.
Yeah.
Can we answer that question?
Go ahead.
I'll defer to Marlene first.
The reason it's given broad is because silviculture or farmland or forest preservation is a type of farming that if you look at New Jersey, they have a stewardship forest program where it's a tree farm program. And that was put in here to contemplate that in the future. If the council sponsors would like to amend that and take out silviculture, that's possible. But
I don't mean to be rude, and I will go for the chuckle.
Okay.
When I heard no farmers, no food, I don't think we're talking about the beavers.
No, I understand.
I mean, that's just my concern. Whether and all I'm saying, if we're preserving woodlands as that, then that's what it should. That's what it should be.
Right. And just as a point of information, there are viable tree farms, whether they're Christmas tree farms or whether they're farms.
I go to one, lay on my back, and cut every year.
And also farms that provide trees for development.
Let's put it this way. And again, this is a workshop. I would hope. I mean, that's my understanding of why we did this.
Right.
Then I think there needs to be some type of process or procedure, albeit through the trust, that if something is in the program for a specific purpose, i.e. As a farmland, and it wishes to change the type of agricultural use, not going from corn to tomatoes or to whatever, but if they're going to go to a tree farm, then that should come back through, and the trust should have some input and make a decision on that. Just a suggestion. I'm just trying to reach a comfort level.
Right, and that may be to echo on Councilman Weiner's comments and Councilman Powers' comments. It is a matter of steps to get the trust where it's going to be up and running to address the nuances of agriculture and aquaculture even could be brought in later. Silviculture could be carved out, and you could have a transition phase from the type of farming done. But we, when we drafted the legislation, we viewed it to try to get the basic steps covered with the enabling legislation. And then if we have nuances and amendments that need to be made later to address a variety of issues that will arise, like you're saying, that could be put in here. I'll certainly defer to the council members with that. Here's my concern. I have
routinely over the years referred to legislation as a work in progress. Mm-hmm. But once we approve this, it's no longer our work. It's totally up to the trust. So, you know, to quote my wife when she has said something I haven't heard her a week later, silence is consent. So I'm not being silent. I want to express my concerns. Now, again, like I said, we do other legislation. I may have questions and doubts and concerns, but I'm comfortable because I know I can revisit that down the road. This isn't going to be the case for council, so that's why I try to get it out.
I just want to, and again, I'm not trying to shoot it down, Councilman Power, just myself. For the record,
I believe Councilman Bell had his hand up.
I'll yield to Councilman Powers, but with the understanding I can.
We understand I'm still going, right?
Right.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Well, forestry, forestry is part of agriculture, and I don't think there's too many farms that don't have forest, and cultivated forests are, you know, lumber.
I understand.
I mean, it's agriculture. Aquaculture is still part of farming. You know, part of it is to sustain a farm is to make it profitable. And that would be whatever, and that could change over the years. I mean, a few years ago, because of biofuels, the state forestry on the Blackbird Forest planted some trees that grew really fast that they wanted to harvest for energy. Now that's kind of slowed down with some of the gas lines, but that is part of agriculture.
I understand, Councilman Bowers. I mean, I know agriculture. Believe it or not, my grandparents had a farm, and I was allowed there once. That being said, I feel, and still do, that if there's going to be a change, it ought to come back to the trust. The trust ought to be aware of what they have out there. I'm assuming the idea is throughout the state or whatever, there'll be an inventory of what type of things we have out there.
To take forestry out of it, then you're tying their hands.
Was not my suggestion.
I know. It was just what she had said.
For instance, I used to work with a guy. His wife found a piece of property down in Dover. Had a lot of woodlands on it. He signed a contract for the home, for the property. Then he went and got a contract for the lumber. Bought the property, sold the lumber, paid all the property off. So I know there's money in lumber as well.
Councilman Bell?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with Councilman Smiley. I mean, this is why we have the workshop, to kind of vent all this and to ask the questions, and those that we don't have answers for today to get the answers for. But, you know, I was the one that actually said, as a district council person, no farms, no food. Mm-hmm. And it was basically to emphasize the importance of our farm families and our farmland and the fact that farming is still agriculture in the state of Delaware is still the number one industry. And that it's incumbent upon us to try to do something to preserve our farms. And you know,
I wasn't referencing that to make light of it. I was just trying to make my point. Can I move to the next one?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Just a point of information on that question.
Which one?
The one that is now currently he raised before he goes to the next one.
About the forest?
About multitude of uses that aren't necessarily food. Just have a point to add, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have one of my two proud farmers here, Mr. Stuart Ramsey, and he'll let you know that for his farm to survive, it's got to have other uses to be sustainable in the 21st century other than just farmers for food. And whether it's the hay rides or the fruit stands or the other things that Stuart does.
Environmental tours,
yes.
It's all part of it.
It's all part of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, next. Mm-hmm. I heard what what the sponsor said about going to five with concern about the quorum. I would make a suggestion that you take a look at the ethics bylaws and procedures whereby, because of this very possible thing, they require four yes votes in order to ratify. So if you've got seven people there and it turns out four of them can't vote, you don't run into the issue. They basically have to have four yes in order to adopt a motion. So I would ask maybe you take a look at that. Maybe, and I think that would resolve any of the problems about how many there. You have your quorum, but you have four yes votes. So if you have people that have work, so anyway. just a suggestion, because I've that's seen it work through the Ethics
right.
Commission.
Right. Let's address. Yeah, but before it goes forward, can we address that issue? We can't remember all these questions. It's just easier to address them now.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I just speaking from myself, and I think I just heard from the lead sponsor, I think that's an excellent suggestion, that you increase your quorum to five, but you still require four votes because of ethical issues, and one of the members is going to be from the farming yes. industry. So that's a really good point.
One of the two.
One okay. of the two. Yeah.
Moving right along. 29.02.102A, where we say, and I'm drawing on what we've been going through here the last few years, let me find specific part, where it lists the board shall work with data from the Department of Land Use to ensure that parcels required by the trust are not, and it lists things. I think it should be in there as well, again, my own opinion, that they would work through the Department of Law as well to make sure no parcel is involved in litigation with Newcastle County. We've got the law department negotiating with owners of a parcel to try to resolve an issue, be it sewer access or whatever. I think that has to be known to the trust. If we're being sued by a farmer, you shouldn't be suing us with the left hand and working to get farmland preservation money with the right. So I'm not saying that, but I think they should work with them so that they're aware.
So a disclosure.
Yes.
Not so much a requirement, but a disclosure.
Comfortable with that.
I don't think the sponsors have any problem with that, and I would just like to add for the record that under the strict fiduciary duties imposed upon fiduciaries under Delaware law, that would certainly be consistent with that duty.
Last one. 29.02.101D, top of the opposite page. This is my finance co-chair hat coming out now. The trustees shall not be entitled to compensation for the services they provide to the trust. However, each trustee shall be entitled to reimbursement for actual necessary expenses incurred to enable the performance of official duties. Who would oversee that? Who would authorize those expenditures? Would that be among themselves or like the ethics board? They vote themselves whether to approve someone to travel or to this. Is that the way it would work here? And then they would send their approval through finance, or
that's the way it's contemplated, because that's the way it's also done with the pension board.
Right.
Trustees get, when someone, as we have new trustees coming aboard the pension board, you're all aware of, there is specific education that they all undergo upon beginning their trusteeship, if you will. And the board presents it, everyone votes on it, it usually goes forward.
Okay.
So it would be similar to what we have with the Ethics Commission, the Pension Board. So we don't want to do something drastic. This seems to work very well for the Pension Board, as an example, and certainly there's no reason to differ for this trust.
Yeah, just again, this board is going to be formed, and for all intents and purposes, start from scratch, drafting their bylaws, their rules, their procedures. So we're just trying to get as much out there as possible.
Right, and that's to just as a point of information, the idea or the guide behind this proposed legislation was indeed partially the pension board, if you look how that's set up in the code, so that we have consistency with our board and the board practices. And one of the caveats for a board that's okaying its own expenses, that, if you will, out of its own fund, is that they are public meetings.
Yes.
And they are subject to FOIA, as you would ask, I believe you would ask previously. So there's certainly a citizen oversight. Aside from private loans and private gifts, it is taxpayer money, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I apologize, but I don't have any more.
There's nothing to follow. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to make note that you're holding true to your reputation for conducting your marathon land use meetings.
Thank you.
We almost should have put this at its own workshop. But,
that's what I thought we were doing.
That's what I thought
we were doing. Yeah. I have about 15 questions, but I am going to defer them all, and I will email them out, you know, because I wish we would have voted this last Tuesday.
Yeah.
But Councilwoman Diller, before she left, did ask me to propose a question, and I too share the concerns. But when it talks about the funding to the trust, originally I think we heard too that, you know, we would be able to solicit funds and stuff too for this trust, I think. But anyhow, it talks about the funding of the trust. Is that overseen by the Ethics Commission on how those funds can be solicited and brought into the trust? Because obviously it's not just county bond money. But.
As this is a county board, Councilman Ayers, and we can clarify that in the legislation if the sponsors wish to do so, all our boards, trusts, our boards, committees, and commissions are overseen by the Ethics Commission. You know, they're all subject to their original bound of their oversight. You know,
they wouldn't
be excluded from. I guess I'm not quite sure how to answer that.
Well, I was going to give you an example real quick. Councilwoman Diller, in conjunction with another council member, hello over here, they went out and held a, and this is what she said, you know, they conducted a committee seminar over in Newcastle, and they got a speaker to come out, and they solicited funds and ended up paying this, and it ended up kind of getting their wrist slapped a little bit is what she shared. And she was wondering how that's going to affect, let's say, this trust and soliciting money and the guidelines they have to do it under.
Could you repeat what you said about the example? I apologize.
Yeah, I can help you. Council has since promulgated rules and guidelines, so no one would be flying in the blind in the future.
So they'd be under those rules that propagated from that experience?
Yes.
Councilman?
My next one? I'll email.
Who to?
We're running pretty long on this. So let's give a short question or answer, because I know that the public had their hands up. So, Councilman Bell?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually glad that we didn't vote on it the last meeting. I think that this is very beneficial to all of us of council, and I think that some of the points have been raised. All three, the lead sponsor as well as the co-sponsors, have already agreed to certain things that fellow council had brought up that we think is important to change and be in there, and with some further legal clarifications and everything, I think then when this is done and when it's passed, it'll be done the right way. And so it's an important piece of legislation. It's important to the future. There were points made in the budget hearings by Councilman Cartier about identifying, and Councilman Smiley, both the chairs, about clearly identifying when we're approving funds, what are they meant for. And so that's all important, and that's why, and you've done an excellent job in chairing this session.
Councilman Powers?
I have a few people here that are, which you had just said right after that, and one of them is on the State Farmland Preservation Board, and the question that was asked by John, I think he could really answer, you know, the need. One thing I do want to tell you that there's a lot of funds that have gone from Newcastle County to the State Foundation. The rollback tax for the past 10 years has been $500,000 that has gone to the foundation for administration. So when you're saying we gave $500,000 this past year, we've given a lot more than $500,000. And especially with the
transfer fees, that's where the $10 million comes from, and we're probably putting in almost half the money into the state program. So when you turn around and we're giving half the money, we get less than half back, and then we have to give another $500,000 to get it. Now, the other thing that was said with applying for some of these things, soliciting, some of it will be just applying. NRCS money, I'll bet any money if we look at the state, they didn't even use state funds. They probably used USDA funds because the farms up here qualify more for state federal funds than the other two counties because it has to do with more urban areas. That would be somebody to make sure that we get the money brought back in. Now, on that end, if we had gone and used our county money and the federal money out of what has been said from the foundation, they would have to give us a one-to-one match for those two monies. So to get our fair share back, and talking to Mike McGrath for years, this is the only way we could do it. Mike would say, if you don't like it, don't get in it. He said it to a lot of guys sitting in here.
Councilman Weiner, do you?
I have nothing.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to just say one thing. With the questions that were asked, Marlene, you have them written down? Or? And the only reason why I'm saying this is because if not, I wish the council people that had the multiple questions would email them or write them down, and so we can look at them and what was discussed today. So if there's any changes or added to this 040 ordinance or resolution,
it's gonna be,
I think,
resolution.
Ordinance, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it'll be
that we can adopt it in there so we can look at it again to make sure that the day of the meeting that this is brought up, we can vote on it at proper time for or against, so that we can have everything in there. Because I know Councilman Smiley had a few questions, Councilwoman Patrick, and
I don't want to belabor it, but I know we're going to end up with a substitute. So I would think that possibly if there's another before that, we'll discuss
if
it.
If the questions can go in,
I'll send mine over.
At least we can have them.
Well, my comments.
Let's keep the record open and send the comments over.
Right. With that. I believe Mr. Ramsey had your hand up.
Sure. Stuart Ramsey, Ramsey's Farm. And it's been interesting hearing all the dynamics in the room, and I think that's helped me maybe focus what I'd like to share with the group. You know, I'm a special kind of farmer. I think we're all special. I actually rent every single acre that I farm right now. It's not really by choice. I mean, I couldn't buy ground where I'm at. But of the ground I do farm, some of which has just been preserved through the national park. The bulk of the farm that I farm today is part of the national park, and that maybe underscores somewhat of the importance. I'm expanding my farm, and I actually have to by necessity. To be sustainable, I've got to get bigger. I want to include my son in it. I'm in the process of renting a farm just over the line in Pennsylvania, literally contiguous to Delaware, that will double the size of my farm, and most of it is already preserved. And I wouldn't be able to rent it if it wasn't preserved. I also wouldn't be able to make investments in it, or let's just say the landlord wouldn't allow me to build a building, which is a necessity for me to expand my operation if it wasn't already preserved. And maybe one other piece to that is that my wife and I are actually looking at buying a farm, and the only farms that we can legitimately look at are preserved. I mean, we can't buy development rights to farm. We could buy development rights, meaning a fancy house, if that's the only thing we wanted. But if we want a farmland asset, we can't afford the development rights. That's how important it is. Just one other thing. Just to show you the dynamics. And I was Jerry Heisler is sitting here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I rent assets from Jerry. He's actually, a part of that whole plan, which, progress has to happen, and I'm not speaking for or against anything that he's asking to have happen. But, one of the farms that I'm involved in will go away as a function of that. While at the same time, I rent ground that he has some control over, and that's just the life that's the dynamic of what the day I live. So if that other piece was preserved, I could feel even more confident. I know it's not. and we've mentioned Woodlawn in this, you know, in this room today. And not everything that Woodlawn has, well, has been preserved, or probably will be preserved. You know, again, we don't have perfect certainty, but the incremental amounts of certainty that we can get help us immensely. And you know, as a former, I mean, I have to, I can't stay on my current footprint. The technology doesn't allow it. You know, I can't even buy equipment small enough to farm the same size farm if I stay that size. And I can't, you know, I couldn't be competitive if I did. So I have to grow, I have to rent ground. And actually, just one other comment, you know, Emerson's, and they're going to speak to them, but they're much bigger than I am, but they rent ground. The biggest farms in Delaware, absolute biggest farms in Delaware, if they lost their rented ground, their critical mass would change dramatically. So that's just the way it is. None of us own all of our assets, but we do need some security of even the rented ones. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question. The Woodlawn Trustees portion that's become National Park, when we asked the feds, they said, we'll be able to continue the uses once we check them out. Will you continue to farm on that National Park portion?
Yeah, I mean, I am absolutely as involved in that process as they will let me be at this point, which includes a meeting that's coming up. Last Thursday, I met with the head of National Park Service out of Washington, the local person, Russ Smith, who will be on, you know, kind of feet on the ground. And basically, they tell me right now, you know, 3 to 5 years, nothing will change. And that's interesting. You know, it's like that's good news, bad news, because if nothing will change means that I can't change anything. That could be a death sentence. I'm not saying, but so I'm going to ask them to make decisions before 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But my intention
certainty
is to continue to farm there and actually expand.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one other thing I just want to share with the group how hard it is to move a farm because I've contemplated this. I've looked at farms up in Chester County, I've looked at farms in Cecil County, Maryland, and I'll tell you the reality. One of my best friends who is in Chester County, he's a dairy farmer, or retired dairy farmer, he's farmed there all his life. He's the way he characterized it to me, he said, if you move in my backyard, he said, you won't live long enough to be able to get control of enough land to make your farm profitable. You know, I live in a neighborhood that my family's been in there since 1860. I have some equity in that. You know, the Meanies from High Point, you know, we're like family, but at the same time, we're in the neighborhood, you know, competing back and forth. But we're two known commodities, so when I go to a local landlord, they know what they're going to get. And in fact, that's how I'm getting some of the farmland that I'm going to get. They know how I farm, they drive by my farm every day, and they say, I want to see that on my property. If I move to Chester County, Pennsylvania, if I move to Cecil County, Maryland, I will not live long enough create critical mass for my farm and condition. Thank you.
Anyone else?
I'm Robert Emerson. I'm a dairy farmer in southern Newcastle County. I just would like to see the county do something. I think it'd be critical to save farms. I've lived on the farm where I live at. My parents moved there in 1943. I'm 67, so we've been there for quite a while. This is my grandson, who's the fourth generation, and we're just trying to be able to buy a farm or something like that through the farmland preservation or something in that nature, because we can't physically buy a farm for $50,000 an acre, just like a farm sold on the northern part of St. George's, just and try to do farming. And to speak about the changes in the farming, I guess I look at it every different way. I'm right in the middle of Bayberry and Whitehall. If you told my father and grandfather that there would be 5,000 houses within my farm, they would say, you're crazy. That's just all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schultz?
Peggy Schultz, League of Women Voters of Newcastle County. The League is very interested in farmland preservation, and several of our members have
have some questions, and the most important question, I know we're short on time here, but we'd like to know specifically how this ordinance addresses checks and balances for this board. It seems quite autonomous, and you don't have to respond tonight because you all want to.
Ms. Schultz, I suggest if you have multiple questions that you would send them in to the council so they can get them to the law department.
That's the only one I want to present, just that.
And that's a good one.
Maybe we should send them to Chrissy.
So, Mr. Chair, it's a legal question. I'm happy to address it, but I'm sure Marlene can as well.
Well, we have Marlene here that, I mean, she's going to.
I think she should go first.
And I think it'd be good for her to answer.
Right.
She needs to practice.
You're concerned about the checks and balances because it's a somewhat autonomous trust. Well, as Councilman Weiner said, there are, just being a trust in and of itself, the members have fiduciary duties under Delaware law.
Right.
Just as trustees.
She's
first
like
and
Coles.
Foremost.
Yeah.
That's what you said, right? The legislation is, as we've said often here, flexible to allow the trust to get up and running and to get the programming.
Yes, I'm glad you went away.
There are certain, safeguards, especially for conflict of interest, for financial or familial ties. And that section of this proposed legislation was taken out, or not taken out, but crafted as closely to the state code as possible for the state's foundation. Also, because it's a public body, it's subject to public oversight as well. And obviously subject to state FOIA. But the board is treated as this semi-autonomous entity, if you will, so that there's no greater influence by one branch of government than the other. So that the trust can effectively preserve the farmland that's dying in Newcastle County. As objectively
as possible.
So certainly as a county board, the Ethics Commission oversight that it would have for other boards, commissions, and committees. That applies here, if you will. And also, it's not without the entirety of the proposed legislation doesn't allow the trust to act in contravention of county council or county executive or the interests of the county taxpayers. Is that close to what you're looking for?
We were concerned that members can be appointed any number of times.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and I'll quickly address that, is if you look on the county's website, you'll see that there are several boards with many vacancies. And unfortunately, not all our citizens are willing to participate in the board, so it does become difficult for the county and county council, because it's both the county as a whole, both the executive aspect and the council's aspect of county government, to populate these boards. Because unfortunately not all citizens are engaged, and if we can have a good board, we have members of the pension board that have served for a very long time, very effectively. So we do have to balance that, because if we have to be able to populate it. And if we do too many term limits, I mean, we may run out of people here in Newcastle County, unfortunately.
Just, I probably have 20 of them.
Thank you.
Councilman Redder, if I may address you very briefly, you asked me if I had everybody's questions, and I do have the amendments to which the sponsors agreed, and I expect I'll be receiving questions from Councilman Patrick and
Councilman Smiley.
Smiley and
Maybe Councilman.
And I think
Councilwoman Diller and Councilman Tackett.
What I'll do is I'll send my comments to her, copy all of council, and the sponsors can comment directly to her as they see fit.
That's fine.
And that's fine. And I'll just say, if you one thing is that if you look at the statistics from the state of Delaware, as I was researching the legislation to draft it for the sponsors, you'll see how many farms are preserved in Kent and Sussex County, which is certainly a good thing, but how few are preserved in Newcastle County. Mm-hmm. And if we can all, I feel I'm getting old, but hopefully I'm not that old, but I can recall when I was a little kid and you drive down 13 and 9, and they were very big, very productive farms, and a lot of them are gone. So right. We think it's very important legislation.
And Route 42.
Anything on the other? Mm-hmm.
I do, and I'll be quick. You can pass this down just to look at it if you want. Some years back, I tried to get the state to take a look at if they were going to give someone a business license, make sure it fit the neighborhood. That didn't work. I'm still working on that. I recently had a situation come up where I became aware that there was a problem because people in the neighborhood go get a permit. The county gives them the permit, and it violates the deed restrictions. Recognize we don't enforce deed restrictions. I drafted a proposal, went to land use, and much to my very, very pleasant surprise, they'd already been working on it. So what I've been waiting to get in front of the land use committee just to show you is this is to be on every form, but what they've done so far, and this is on the residential deck, they have to sign off, and where they say is the construction and or use will conform to Newcastle County Code and other applicable laws and regulations which relate to the property. We don't enforce it, but what that does is if they come in, they get a permit, they sign this, and it's in violation of deed restrictions, it gives the maintenance corporation or civic association another leg to say, you falsified this document when you went and got the permit. So I just wanted to share this with all the members of council so that they'd be aware of it. Because I had two above ground pools in violation. One's agreed to take it down. The other one, the maintenance corporation, has to take to court. Mm-hmm. But this, like I said, just a few words on a piece of paper. And again, land use had it done before I got there. Not at my request. That's great, and we're going to do them all of the permit requests, right?
Anything under other?
So, just wanted to share that with everyone.
Is this the newest permit from land use? This is what's there?
It's the application I got about 3 weeks ago, maybe it was.
Because I worked on
that's just for a deck.
Yeah, but I had worked on the permit thing years ago with
that's
Wendy.
That's been on the permit thing.
Okay.
That piece has?
I think so.
I thought it was just being worked on. Well then,
I think it's on the application.
Then I've been remiss because I need to make sure my maintenance corporations know this because they don't know they can go back and get this.
But that's what I've
okay.
That's what I've
I'd never known it was there before.
I told them to FOIA you the permit because I said it's right there and we've got a thing that says, you know,
I didn't try to take credit for it, Deb. But I'd never been aware of it.
Right on the merry.
I do everything without a permit myself.
Public comment. Okay.
Motion adjourned.
Second. I guess we're out of here.
None opposed?